All rise, please. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Supreme Court of the State of Idaho is now in session pursuant to law.
Please be seated. Good morning, and welcome you to this term of the Idaho Supreme Court of the State of Idaho for August 25th, 2022. The hearing before the court is an appeal on Pinkton versus, is it Plate? Am I saying that correctly? Commissioner David Plate, Rebecca Jensen, and Terry Felix Home, LLC, are appealing, represented by Jetta Hatch Matthews. The respondent is Scott Matt and Pinkton, who are represented by John Stenquist. Counsel, do you have preliminary matters for the court this morning?
Nothing, Your Honor.
No, Your Honor.
Very well then, Ms. Matthews, you may proceed.
Rebecca Jensen, David Plate, and Three Peaks Home, LLC. The substance of this appeal is whether the plaintiffs and the district court must apply the rules of civil procedure and comply with them in entering a default and default judgment, and whether the court abused its discretion in refusing to set aside a default and default judgment that were entered in violation of the rules of civil procedure. The case arises out of a construction defect case, and my clients were contracted with the respondents to build a custom home. The substance, of course, of this appeal does not really depend on the substantive arguments or the claims in the case, but rather the procedural aspect. As a short recap, as I'm sure Your Honors are familiar with the case, the complaint was filed. It was answered, and my clients filed a counterclaim. At some later point, both sides moved for summary or partial summary judgment. The partial summary judgment was entered in favor of one of the defendants, Legacy Homes, with regard to a lease pendant, and the motion by the respondents to for summary judgment on the lease pendants filed by my clients was denied because the court found that there were issues of material fact as to the amounts owed between the parties, including the counterclaim by my clients for amounts still owed. As relevant here, Mr. Pinkham filed a declaration alleging that all of the bills for materials and services that had been submitted to them had been paid. And my client, Ms. Jensen, filed a similar affidavit outlining the basis for additional amounts that were owed under the contract. And it was on the basis of those competing affidavits that the court found that there was a dispute of fact. Thereafter, there was a dispute between my clients and their attorney, and which was lack of communication, whichever, which resulted in their attorney withdrawing. The court entered an order allowing the withdrawal, and included in that order was a provision that should they not appear either in person, in writing, or by representative, that a dismissal or default could be entered without further notice. And that's where the present controversy really begins, Your Honor. Although it's undisputed that service was made upon my clients, it's also undisputed that they did not receive that notice in a timely manner.
What's the significance, at least in my argument, of the district court's memorandum decision denying the motion set aside? But in my view, it didn't really address this question of being served, I think he says, by rules once it's mailed, certified mailer, otherwise they're being served. Is that matter established for purposes of record, or is that a question that we are wrestling with yet today?
I believe, Your Honor, there's no dispute as to whether service was made question here is whether notice was given. And in part, the issue has to do with the later development that at some point my clients became aware that their attorney had withdrawn. They did not receive the letters or the order from either their attorney or the court.
Counsel, did they receive the motion to withdraw?
I don't know whether they did or not. I don't believe it was served on them.
Well, the certificate of service indicates it was served on them, and I didn't see any mention in the record whether they received the motion or not.
That I do not know, Your Honor. I apologize. It's not in the record. We came rather late to this matter, and so therefore I do not know all those facts.
Well, this was a certified letter. Was there not some evidence of when it was delivered or when it was received?
Any evidence of when it was delivered or received would have gone back to Mr. Schuster, and again, that's not in the record. And I believe we contacted him, and he did not have any evidence of whether it was signed for or whether it was returned.
What we do know, though, is that apparently the notice of the hearing, the notice of the default, the notice of the order on the request to withdraw were all sent to the same address, that the letter came from advising the court that they were having difficulty in locating an attorney. What should we infer from that?
Well, Your Honor, I know that is the address, and there's kind of a balancing here between that is the address that was included in the letter with the fact that the letter did not arrive. And there's no evidence in the record as to whether, for whatever reason, the letters were lost. This was a storefront, is my understanding. It's in a strip mall. Whether they never arrived or whether there was, as the district court believes, that no one was checking the mail. I don't have any record. There's no record which of those that is. But this kind of ties into the point that when filing the notice for default, there has to be not the last record of evidence or the last address of record, but the plaintiffs need to file a certification against whom the default is going to be entered, and also the address most likely to provide notice. And the plaintiffs had several different addresses that they believed to be home addresses that they had identified as early as April of 2020 when they filed an affidavit by Mr. Pinkham in support of their amended complaint. Well, their amended complaint was filed in August, but this was dated in April.
Well, this might touch then on the ultimate good faith analysis that we're likely going to have to get to. It seems like this difficulty with your clients and contacting them dates at least back to August when the discovery issues started to arise and promises were made and not kept. And I suspect that's what led to Mr. Schuster's withdrawal from the case. So at what point should your clients have been aware, like, assuming in good faith that there was a mail problem? It seems like it dates all the way back to August, not December.
Well, I have no evidence that any mail correspondence was being carried out between Mr. Schuster and my clients. That would certainly be against the common practice, I think, of most attorneys these days. To me, sending anything by mail is just kind of an admission that it's not that important, certainly not urgent. Especially with the mail lately. I mean, once upon a time, you could get a letter across town in one day, maybe 2 days. And I remember before we had electronic filing, which is a blessing, it would sometimes take 4 days, 5 days. I don't know, Twin Falls appeared to have been in Black Hole. It took 7 days once to get a letter. So the importance of mail, I think, has to be considered in the context of present day practices. And that's one of the things that the court found, is that that it was contrary to reason that a litigant would not be checking their mail in the middle of a court case, because service is complete upon mailing. But they never would have received any service by mail, because that would have gone to their attorney. This is not something they would have been looking for. And all of my communication with my clients is almost exclusively by email or phone, or occasionally, unfortunately, text.
Well, when your clients submitted the letter to the court asking for additional time, I mean, it seemed to me when I read that letter that it was very clear that they knew what the order was and they knew what the time limit was because they said, we need additional time. I mean, they knew at that point.
And that's one way that it could be read, Your Honor. It could just be read that they understood that, you know, they didn't have an attorney and they needed to have one now. That they were represented previously, and that's the normal and ordinary case of litigation. I would say particularly where they were, two of the entities were LLCs required to be represented by counsel, and so they could have inferred that. That's all that we have is those words. They can be interpreted in various ways.
If mail is such an old-fashioned mode of communication that your clients don't use, what do we infer from the fact that they sent a physical letter to the judge on December 23rd? It looks like they used the same mode of communication.
Well, Your Honor, it's my understanding that at that point, that was pretty much the only way you could have got... Well, I don't believe it was actually mailed, Your Honor. You notice the date is December 23rd, and it was actually filed on December 23rd as well. I don't believe it was mailed. But they can't do electronic filing because they're a pro se plaintiff or a pro se defendant, and the courthouses were a little difficult to get into as general rule in December of 2020. Many of them were pretty much locked down unless you had a pretty good excuse to physically be there. They were not as open access as we currently are.
Our courthouses were locked down in December of 2020?
Because of COVID. There was
I'm aware of the COVID pandemic, but I'm not aware that our courthouses were locked down.
There was not the same open access that there was. It varied by county, I believe.
Is there any evidence that that was the case in this county?
No, they're not in the record, Your Honor. I'd have to go back to the administrative orders at the time.
And so my struggle with trying to interpret the language of this letter is if we're going to get to a reasonable person or good cause or good faith analysis, wouldn't a reasonable person, as soon as they were told by the neighbor, hey, you know, we're not representing you anymore, wouldn't they pick up the phone and call their lawyer if they truly had no idea what was going on and say, what's going on? Why is this happening? What does this mean?
Well, that's one option. I think a lot of people may very well think, well, okay, he's not my attorney anymore. He's not going to talk to me.
Just taking on the word of a neighbor?
Well, the neighbor worked in Mr. Schuster's office, I believe, is what they explained in Ms. Jensen's later affidavit, is that this was not just a random neighbor, it was someone who worked in Mr. Schuster's office.
Right, but still, they hadn't heard it from their own lawyer. So why are they going to take the word of this person who catches them on the street who happens to work at the law firm? I mean, that's my struggle, is it seems like a reasonable person would call and either call the lawyer or call the court and say, what's happened? I have no clue this was happening.
Mm-hmm. Well, and like I say, there's various ways. I think that I don't think there's one way that a reasonable person would react. I think one reasonable way is to say, gee, I need to get counsel, and you know, it's December 23rd now. Christmas is coming. Not going to be able to get counsel over Christmas because most people, there's a lot more difficulty when people take vacations. And so they ask for additional time. And so there's various things that you could look at in part, but I think if you look at the entirety of the circumstances, I mean, the question with a failure to defend is whether the person is intending to defend. And that's what an appearance is notice of an appearance. And this letter, certainly, just by filing it, indicates that they intended to continue to defend the case. They are involved in the case. Whatever their prior actions have been, they are taking action at this point.
And they're coming until March to get you all in the case, right? And we're talking about almost 90 days?
Yes, there was a lot of issues with insurance policies and coverage and reservations of rights that were being worked out behind the scenes. And, you know, while it's been suggested, well, couldn't they just get an attorney? It's really hard to get an attorney if you have no money and you already have default judgments against you. You're not going to get a contingent attorney. You're not going to take that bet. especially in a construction defect case where you've got, you know, it's going to be very fact-intensive, there's probably going to be lots of depositions, there can be experts involved. This isn't just some simple thing that you can just walk in and say, gee, I have no money, will you please take my case anyway? And so that's what my clients were up against, and they did take this step. And the question is, you know, default is disfavored, and it should not be, they should not be applied in, as a remedy unless other actions could be seen, could be taken that, to allow a judgment on the merits. And in this case, there was no, the court didn't consider this letter at all. I mean, it just signed the order that was presented to them. There's no discussion about their discretion to enter a judgment or a default. There was no discussion of the failure to provide the 3 days notice that's required by Rule 55A. And you know, as we briefed, Rule 11.3 no longer allows a court to enter a default based on a withdrawal of an attorney without that notice. So no notice was provided.
And so, well, I want to circle back to the prospect of insurance. Was there ever a tender earlier on? Or was there ever a reservation of rights asserted before Mr. Schuster left the employ of your clients?
I don't know any of that, Your Honor, and it's certainly not in the record. I do know that that's how we came in, is because of insurance, that it's under a reservation of rights, and there was a bit of backroom wrangling about how that would occur. So there's two issues on appeal here, and one is the default. So we've discussed that, and I think in our briefing we've made a good point that, one, the letter could be considered an appearance under the rules that have been established, and the fact that they did not receive the actual order, I think, needs to be taken into consideration, and it really wasn't. But the other issue, and again, that there was no notice provided. The three-day notice is required, and it was clearly not provided. But the other question is the entry of the default judgment itself. And the first part that I want to make is that there are two requirements for an application for a default judgment, and neither of them was met in this case. One, there has to be a certification of the parties against whom it's being sought. And two, there has to be a certification of the address most likely to provide notice of the judgment. And that the address most likely to provide notice, that to me just really brings due process. That's the classic iteration of notice in federal jurisprudence in particular. And in this case, that clearly was not included in the notice of intent to take default, neither of those. In fact, the judgment was actually entered in an incorrect name, because Rebecca's Jensen's name was mysteriously changed from what it had been through the entirety of the litigation. But there's those two rules were clearly not met. And then there's the second issue of the scope of the judgment and the basis for it. And this is where, I mean, there's substantial prejudice to the clients here, because it was entered in an amount and a time that was not in the complaint in two respects. One, the complaint does not state an amount. And two, all of the defendants, with the exception of Mr. Hall, who was not defaulted and still a party, were found jointly and severally liable. And there's two points here. Rebel Crew was not even one of the people against whom a default was sought. He's not included in the application. It just appears in the judgment. But secondly, the joint and several liability is not was not alleged against all of the parties to whom it was applied in the judgment. That's a very substantial change to our usual rules of liability. And
does that make the judgment void or voidable?
The language in the cases would be voidable, I believe, there's some variation between whether it's void or voidable. They seem to be used fairly interchangeably. And in this case, where we sought to set it aside, I think that would be a basis to void it if it is voidable. And it would be voidable under Rule 60B is the key here. It can be set aside. And that would be a basis for it. Again, there was no notice of, no separate notice of the default judgment. And there was, the district court was really at a disadvantage in entering this order and judgment, because nothing in the application or the motion for a default judgment indicated the basis for it. It did not indicate, you know, what legal theory, didn't indicate what evidence the court should consider. All the court got was just a basis for entering a default and a vague reference to the filings in the case, which I would note would include Ms. Jensen's affidavit stating that the plaintiffs owed her money, or that owed Three Peaks money, and that the court had already found there was a material issue of fact as to how much was owed to each party. And so the court didn't have anything really to go on, and in fact did not provide any explanation. If my client had appealed the judgment directly rather than trying to set it aside, this court would have had nothing to review. It could not have determined the basis for this, for the judgment, how the court determined the amount. There would have been nothing. And that, I think, is fatal to a judgment, where there's simply no explanation. But even after the court entered an explanation in the motion to, in its memorandum decision, it still is not really very helpful to the court, because it just generally says that it determined a measure of damages and a basis for calculating damages and an adequate amount, but there's no explanation as to what that basis is, why it determined the amount was adequate. It states that it reviewed the declaration of Scott Pinkham, but Mr. Pinkham's declaration doesn't assert damages. It just asserts how much was paid. If I paid $40,000 for a car, but there was a defect in a wheel, I could say, well, it's defective, but I can't claim $40,000 damages. I get the difference.
You could if you never got the car.
If I didn't get the car, but they have a house. They have walls, they have foundation, they have roofs, they have fixtures, they have...
Did an occupancy permit have been granted for the house and the condition it was in?
It had not been granted, but the materials were still there. And some of the items that are included in the affidavit of Mr. Pinkham were undisputedly received, and there's no evidence that they could be damages. For example, HOA fees would have to have been paid regardless of who was living there or not living there. The service connect from Idaho Power had to have been received. They had, you know, plans. They had design services. So there's just no explanation of how the court got to this number and why the court believed that these were the appropriate measure of damages, or under what theory and against which parties. Because again, there wasn't an allegation of joint and several liability in the complaint, except for as to Rebel Crew. And Rebel Crew, one, wasn't part of the notice of application for default, and two, had never been served with that version of the complaint. The default had already been entered against them before that was even in part of the claim. They had to be served personally, and there's no evidence that they ever were. So there's, I mean, that's one of the issues that I think has to be considered, is the joint and several liability. If this is a contract claim, there's a contract claim against Three Peaks. That doesn't necessarily mean that it's against the officers or anybody else. If it's a negligence claim, that's a different story. But we don't know what the measure of damages is. So, and the other issue is...
I'm not remembering the specifics of the motion for entry of default judgment. Did it ask for joint and several responsibility?
Not in the application. It would only, and not in the memorandum, it only appeared in the judgment itself. Okay. And there was no mention of Rebel Crew in particular in either of those two, only in the judgment. So there's a difference there. But our final point, and I think we looked at it quite a bit in our briefing, is just that there's no explanation of how the court got to the number it got to. It relied on the affidavit. I don't know where they came, but the affidavit of Mr. Pinkham doesn't add up to the amount of the judgment either. What did the court or did not the court award and why? So there's just not an adequate indication of why that is. I will reserve the remainder of time unless the court has additional questions at this point.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Chief Justice Bevin, Justices, Counsel, may it please the court. This is a construction litigation case fundamentally. There's allegations of fraud and breach of contract. Our complaint alleges that the defendants, they falsified invoices, they used our bank's money to purchase materials and rent equipment and pay for labor that went into other properties. The complaint alleges large sums of money in large categories of claims. They were personally served with the complaint, satisfying kind of the first stage of due process. And they hired good counsel, Greer St. Clair and Mr. Schuster, well-known in the community, well-known attorneys. They filed an answer and significant counterclaims. They sued for $1 million for breach of contract. So we had $1 million plus in claims. They had $1 million in claims, and that was real money back in 2019. And there's a nuance here relating to due process, and that nuance is they're counterclaimants. These are not defendants that were summoned into the court against their will to have their property and rights and liberty to be controlled by the court. They came to the court for relief. They asked this court to enforce $1 million claim against my clients. And I think that's a nuance that's important here when we analyze the due process issues. And we do not believe that Rule 55 applies at all, because Rule 55 was satisfied. Rule 55 relates to those parties who have been served but have not pled or defended, or have been served and have appeared but have not pled or defended. And that's not the case. These defendants defended and filed a counterclaim, and so Rule 55 has been satisfied. And we look to the other rules of civil procedure now that they are part of the process.
So I'm looking at the second sentence of 55A, and it just says, if a party has appeared in the action, that party must be served with 3 days written notice of the application for entry of default before default may be entered. Why does that not apply here? Because they have appeared.
But they also pled and defended, which you have to read. I see it as we have to read the first sentence, the first phrase. If somebody pleads and defends, you can get a judgment, a default judgment. If they have appeared, then you have to give them 3 days' notice to let them know they must plead or defend. I know it doesn't specifically say that, but that has been the practice for over 35 years. And the
practice based on what?
On the Swapper decision, where this issue was raised 35 years ago, where when the rules were changed and 11.3 was instituted, the court said you don't need double notice.
But at that time, didn't 11.3 include language that said without further notice? And that language is no longer in the rule.
That's right. And we believe that language shouldn't be in the rule. It's nowhere else in the rules. And it's, in my view, bad parenting when you say 11.3 grants the district court power to enter judgment after 21 days. But if you don't comply with our 21-day requirement in 11.3, we're going to warn you again and give you another 3 days' notice.
Why isn't that just due process? especially to a party who's appeared.
Because Rule 55 has been satisfied, and now they've availed themselves to the courts. They've had an attorney. They are engaged and are required under Swofford to participate in the action. So due process is required, and 11.3 grants due process for people who have pled and defended. And I'm not, but they don't get additional notice under Rule 55 because we've satisfied that. We've moved on. They've pled and defended. They've appeared, but pled and defended. Now that their attorney is withdrawn, we follow a new set of rules.
And why isn't the last portion of 11.3, where it gives the court options on how to proceed, it says the court may dismiss with prejudice any claims of the party, or may enter default judgment. And so why isn't the reference to may enter default judgment saying, all right, if you're going to go that route, default judgment, we have a more specific rule that addresses that, and you need to follow the procedure in that rule before you can grant default judgment.
Because it doesn't reference Rule 55 and say that and apply Rule 55, it could say that it may determine that default shall be entered and see Rule 55. It doesn't reference back to 55. And the Sherwood case says you don't need to do that. And they shouldn't be entitled to double notice. The court has a very specific process when a party has appeared, defended, and in this case filed a counterclaim. And that process is the attorney files a motion with the court to withdraw. That attorney, who is an officer of the court, certifies the last known address of their client and mails that motion to the client so they can oppose it and attend the hearing. That certification by an officer of the court provides the party with notice that something changes, and the order of the court provides that party with the due process notice that if you don't hire an attorney or indicate that you're going to represent yourself, judgment may be entered against you. This is serious, and you need to participate in this lawsuit that you're pursuing and that you're defending. And so then to say, well, now we're just innocent, summoned parties, we need to go back through this process. There's no requirement that we personally serve them, that we go find them again and personally serve them, which is the basis for Rule 55. Rule 55 wants to make sure people have had adequate service and that they have an opportunity to plead or defend. So when we read the reply brief, it relies heavily on the Radiolink case that has been overturned, which follows that line. But they say now that 11.3 is instituted, we follow this process for default because they're parties.
So is the argument that you're making that if you haven't pleaded and defended, you're entitled to more notice than if you have pleaded and defended?
Well, I would argue that if you pleaded and defended it, you get 21 days notice.
But isn't the gravamen of your argument that you're entitled to more notice if you haven't pleaded and defended?
That's not my argument. My argument is that you're entitled to different notices under
the different Isn't that the effect of your argument?
I don't think it's more notice. The three-day notice, once someone has been served but has not appeared, they get 3 days notice after the 20 days have expired. So I guess they would get 20 days plus 3. Served, don't appear, 20 days plus 3. If you have appeared, pled, defended, you get the notice that your attorney sends you when he files his motion. Then you get the order from the court that gives you 21 days notice to appear with an attorney or just let the court know you're going to represent yourself. And you get a certification from your lawyer underscoring that issue. So
doesn't the court have notice that the defendants were trying to find a lawyer to represent themselves? Isn't that added to the court to notice that that's what's at work?
is, but it's not compliance with the order. It's a request asking for more time. We're trying to find a lawyer. The court looked at that on the motion to set aside, and he did not, he weighed that issue and found they received the notice. We have Mr. Schuster in November 13th, sending his clients a motion of withdrawal at that, and certifying that that was their address and mailing it to them in November. So they're claiming, well, we couldn't find an attorney with a holiday. But really what they're saying is we couldn't find an attorney over two holidays. And in fact, they couldn't find an attorney until March of the appearance. And I think this issue of reservation rights and insurance, and they couldn't afford an attorney, oh, it's not in the record. The court shouldn't consider that. They had requisite notice. And so if you look at the two rules, if you place them side by side, Rule 55 applies to people who haven't pled or defended. They may have appeared, but they still haven't pled or defended. We'll follow that set of guidelines under Rule 55. Similar notice, but not exact dates, 21 days versus 23 days, is provided in Rule 11.3. And they get notice then, okay, we'll give you some time to get an attorney. We'll give you some time to decide if you're going to be pro se. Now, the court received that letter with the address on it, and that's the address that Mr. Schuster was using. And we used that address in our motion for entry of default. And so they did receive notice of that motion 3 days before entry of default, and yet they didn't show up until March to oppose that. And I'm skipping around a little bit, but in the reply brief, they argued for the first time that this was excusable neglect. But if you look at the record, it shows that our writs of execution went out February 22nd, and they claim in their affidavit that they didn't know about the default until February 25th. So you see in the timeline, they didn't care about this litigation until the writs of execution started coming. And so we had a lien on their home that was in first position in front of court the loan, and now they've got to pay. So this effect of having notice from their attorney at that address in November 13th, all the way until the end of March, really is their desire to avoid the consequences of their actions, not pursue the case. So they have ample due process under the rules as we've seen. Now,
what do we make of the fact that Mr. Pinkham was aware of additional addresses for Mr. Plate and Ms. Johnson as set forth in his declaration, and yet they weren't served with copies of any of this at those addresses?
We believe that Rule 11.3 outlines the process. When an attorney withdraws, he certifies the last known address of his client. We had them served, but there's no requirement under 11.2 to reserve them, refind them, try to figure out where they're living today. And there's a lot of facts that make that relevant that are in the record that I won't go over. But as a general concern, if an officer of the court, like Mr. Schuster, certifies to the court that that's the address, and they write a letter showing that address, I think it's not our job to go ensure we'll knock on the door, reserve them with process, and ensure that's the first step of due process, get them in the system so everybody's here. As my Texas client says, now we're cooking with oil, things are moving, they're part of this process. Why do we now have to ensure that these defendants live where they used to live when the litigation started? Or why do we have to ensure that they get personally served with this notice of default under Rule 55 when we fit within 11.3, there is this process in place where the court sends them an order. Let me back up. Mr. Schuster certifies that's their last known address. Now, they could sue him for malpractice for providing the court with the wrong address if he made a mistake, but that lawsuit would be dismissed immediately because they repeated that address. So I think things might be different. We may not be here today, had they put David Clay, Rebecca Jensen, we live at this address. We just heard, well, happening. Please mail here. Okay? Fine. That contradicts the last known address by Lance Schuster, but they used it. And I don't think the court should require us to go back and ensure, or the clerk to go back and ensure that they actually lived in the same place. We have a certification from an officer of the court that that's where they lived. And
doesn't the fact that they use that same address in their own letter take that issue off the table?
I agree with that, because it would be, I mean, this is the worst of circumstances. Even if they had put a different address, my argument would be the same. But why is it our job to reserve them? They obviously know that their attorney is withdrawn. They obviously know they're on the wrong. They're seeking $1 million in damages. At least show up pro se, or hurry up and get an attorney, don't wait till March. I think we'd have a different case as well if they filed a different letter or an appearance in January or February. But it's only until after the writs started coming that they paid attention to the case. This ostrich defense, put your head in the sand, hope nothing happens. They hire a good attorney to get the list pendants removed, then they hire good attorneys to get the default judgment removed. That's when they participate. Otherwise, they're not. Now, going back to the damages issue, I think that's important. We filed list pendants against the real property.
Can you hold on a minute before you move to damages?
Yes.
Because I'm still stuck in Rule 11.3 for just a moment, because I don't think I, in reading this case, I don't think I appreciated nearly as much the distinction between the counterclaims, or the counterclaim, and the claim for damages that the plaintiffs have brought. Under 11.3, I guess it's C3, it says the court may dismiss with prejudice any claims of the party or may enter default judgment against the party. How did the district court dispose of the counterclaim in this case?
I think by entering default, the counterclaim is rendered moot by entering default and a default judgment, because those are offsetting claims. And so by looking at both parties' claims under Sherwood, the court says that when someone fails to pursue their case, fails to get involved, they can assume abandonment of those claims.
But has there been a dismissal?
Of the counterclaims? Yeah. I'd have to go back and look at the record, but the counterclaims would be offsetting claims. And so as the court enters judgment in our favor, we have a judgment against them. They fail to appear to assert their claim. So I guess I can't answer that.
Don't we have to have something to tie up that loose end? I mean, doesn't there have to be an actual acknowledgement by the district court of the dismissal of that counterclaim?
Counsel, here's the language I think we're talking about. This is from the order granting the motion to dismiss. It says, it is hereby ordered, adjudged, and decreed that all claims asserted by Three Peaks, David Plate, Rebecca Jensen, and Legacy Management are hereby dismissed with prejudice.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you. I was up late last night at a swanky party, and I had forgotten that. So thank you, Justice Mueller.
So what's the is there a procedural process for dismissal of those counterclaims that would run through Rule 55 or any place else? Or is something that just, is there any notice requirement that the court has to give?
11.3 allows for that dismissal.
That's
how I read it. Now, obviously 55 wouldn't apply, because 55 applies to parties who have pled or defended.
Not.
You know, so it wouldn't apply. 55 would say, look, you've pled or defended, and so I kind of crossed myself up. But I don't think Rule 55 applies in that instance, because if you have a pled or defended, you don't have a counterclaim to address in 55. I guess that's my point. So it's 11.3 that says, okay, here's a counterclaim. You've pled and defended. Those can be dismissed. I know this court probably is concerned about the judgment and how we get there, because Rule 55 says, wait a second, if you serve someone and they don't show up, you can't just record and get a judgment if you don't think they'll appear. So 55 has some protections, and Rule 54 talks about holding a hearing and showing the court that at least you have a legitimate claim because they should be a gatekeeper. Rule 11.3 does not have those requirements, but in this case, I think we've complied with the fundamentals of due process, even under the guise of 55. And that is, we filed list pendants against property because our position was they have used our loan money to buy materials, and they've used those materials in other homes. They have taken materials that were ordered for our property, and they've put them in other homes.
Those issues are found to be in, there was a genuine issue of material fact as to those issues in the summary judgment motion?
They were, but during that process, we gave the judge a pile of information, and we explained to him that Rebel Crew was just a fake, bogus entity used to defraud the bank. And Ms. Hatch's firm does not represent Rebel Crew. They never appeared. They were a default fraudulent entity in our view. And so we gave the judge a lot of information trying to salvage our list pendants to say, look, here's $400,000 in fraudulent invoices that they used on other homes. Here's all of these issues that we have with the construction home. The walls aren't straight. The roof was halfway built when the electrical was put in, and it rained and it ruined the electrical. We have a driveway that's sunk into the hill. We've got to re-pour that. So we went through this massive amount of kind of argument and detail in the affidavit and in our argument. And from that, the court understood, and we believe we've satisfied that gatekeeper function, that we just didn't walk in and ask for $650,000 out of the board. We had significant claims in our complaint. We had significant allegations of fraud. We had significant numbers in our invoices and the bad payments and all of this stuff. And in our view, we were being extremely light on the amount requested, $650,000. In our view, basically having to rework the whole thing, defraud it out of all this money, we were going light on the record, knowing that we're going to present something that we have something substantiated. Now, we did ask for $900 less, but that's not error giving us less than we asked for. And I don't know why that was, whether our math was different, but we tried to say, look, we have tremendous amount of damages. They're not defending. They're not paying their attorneys. They're not communicating. They're not providing discovery. We're just going to get our judgment and move on, and we have $650,000 that we know is there. It would have been more, I'm sure, had they responded to discovery. And Mr. Schuster indicated in his motion to withdraw, his clients weren't communicating. We had a meet and confer. We were about to file a motion to compel. He couldn't get his clients to respond and provide us those documents, which would have boosted that number. Then he withdrew.
If we were to agree with you that the default was validly entered, but that for whatever reason there wasn't sufficient evidence to ascertain the amount of the judgment, and we remanded for that purpose, are you stating that you would likely ask for more damages on a remand?
We would not, because we would ask for the exact amount, because we don't want that judgment priority date moved. That is the key issue in this case, because they're only defending because we're in first position on a residence, and if we amend that judgment, we will lose that priority date. So from our perspective, we only want what we got in the judgment, even though we know we were damaged. Now, if the court overturns the judgment and we have to start over, we will be asking for significantly more money. But at this point, we're seeking to maintain our priority date on the judgment lien.
That's helpful. Thank you.
So, counsel, my concern with the damage computation is in part the fact that in your memorandum in support of your motion for default and default judgment, you don't reference how you computed damages, you don't reference the amount of damages, and you don't reference the declaration that the district court ultimately relied on to calculate damages. And so I'm struggling with how we figure out what the measure of damages is, because as far as I can tell, the district court relied on a declaration that you didn't even incorporate in your motion.
As an initial matter, if 11.3 applies, I don't think this court doesn't, the court does not need to go through that analysis. That's a Rule 55, Rule 54 analysis, where this court wants to ensure that the court does not just give away these judgments, that they're careful. But
why wouldn't that same requirement apply to a default judgment under 11.3? Why would we treat them differently?
Well, it's not in the rule, and it assumes that the parties have pled and defended, and the court understands the case, so there's, I think there's a lower threshold for that amount. But even if it does, and we want judges to follow the Rule 54 hearing procedures in Rule 11.3 default judgments, even if we want that to happen, those issues were so obvious to the fact finder and to us that when we asked for it, for us it was, this is easy. And the court agreed, looked at the record before him, the pleadings on file, the records, and determined that that was a reasonable amount based upon the records before him. We didn't cite the affidavit of Scott Pinkham, but the court certainly had the right to rely on that, and for us it was just incredibly obvious.
But what about some of the issues that Ms. Matthews has pointed out with the declaration? For example, it references expenditures for things like HOA dues. Why is that something? I can't tell if the district court included that in its calculation or not. It also appears that it includes amounts paid for materials that were actually receive, and so I can't tell what the measure of damages was that the district court applied, and whether it awarded the full amount for those expenditures, even though materials were received, what theory it awarded those under. Isn't all of that incredibly problematic?
I think this court has to decide, under 11.3, are we going to require empty chair trials where we come in and have to present a detailed amount of damages, have the court look at that evidence piece by piece, and spend the time, energy, and money to get to that number.
But that's a suggestion that we abdicate our gatekeeping function. I was a district judge for 20 years, and I never would have issued a default and a default judgment on the same day. That would be an abdication of our responsibility to look at it as a multi-step process. And I would have alerted the defendants to the fact that a default had been entered and that I was going to conduct a hearing on such and such a date, and if they wanted to defend against the entry of a default judgment, they could do so. But but that's the way the process is intended to work.
Under the defendant's own argument, that entire process is moved in this case because they weren't checking their mail. Had we jumped through those hoops? Had we filed a motion?
You're now speculating. If I had been the judge in this case and I sent a notice to the defendant that they needed to put up or shut up, that would be a different case. That's not the case we have.
The judge did send that notice. He sent
it out. He didn't default the defendants and then sent out a notice that this is a two-step process and that we have an obligation as a gatekeeper to not enter a judgment for $650,000 without giving the defendant an opportunity to respond. That's how I think of it as an abhorrence of the forfeiture.
The December 11th notice said that. The December 11th...
And the December 23 letter from the defendant said, we're having problems and we want to defend. I would not have done this in the way that it was done. I can't speak for anybody else, but it's not the way I would have done it.
Well, Well, and I'll back up even more. I don't see in this record where they were ever given notice. This is the amount that's going to be entered in the default judgment if you don't appear. And so I might tend to agree with you if you had done a declaration and said, here's the computation of damages and lined out this is what they're all for, and if you had served that on them at the address, even at the address in their December 23 letter, but I don't see in the record where any of that happened. Instead, your motion and your memorandum in support just say default and default judgment should be entered. There's no amount in there. There's no computation of damages in there, and there's no specific demand in your amended complaint. So I don't see where they ever have notice that $650,000 judgment was going to be entered against them if they failed to appear.
We sued them for over $1 million. They sued us for $1 million. $650,000 should have come as no surprise to them. They knew exactly how much money they had stolen. They knew exactly how much money materials they had built in other projects. The entry of default was them saying, we're not going to fight this case anymore. And that's a big number, but not in the context of these claims and the amounts of issues and the $400,000 that they submitted in fraudulent invoices. This, my heartstrings are not pulling for these folks because the amount is big. They knew it would be big.
But just because someone sues you for $1 million doesn't mean you can assume they're going to get $1 million if they win. If this had been a case where, let's say, you were suing over a vehicle and you wanted the vehicle restored to you, I think your argument would be pretty powerful. Well, they knew that if they get defaulted, they're going to lose the vehicle, because that's what they're asking for. But when you're asking for money damages, especially a large amount like $1 million, I don't think that necessarily implies that you're going to get that if you win. I think that tells you what the limits of your exposure might be, but it doesn't necessarily tell you what's going to actually happen in the case, unlike suing, you know, for the Pleasant type of thing.
Right. I do think that under the circumstances they had notice, they knew exactly what was happening. Any number was unpayable, uncollectible, and this ostrich defense of just hide and hope until maybe we get collected through a writ of execution, I don't think should be rewarded. They were provided due process and they failed to act.
I certainly agree that bad conduct shouldn't be rewarded, but is the default itself a pretty severe penalty? I mean, they're not going to have to prove liability. You're not going to have to prove liability at a subsequent trial. You're just going to have to ascertain your damages. Isn't the default itself a pretty severe sanction for their behavior, which was basically, I suspect, related to lack of cooperation and discovery?
It certainly is. It certainly is, but that's not what Rule 11.3 allows. It allows for the entry of default and the entry of the judgment amount. Our contention is Judge Pickett gave them notice, told them without further notice, default may be entered against you. And we filed our motion, and they just didn't care until the writs were served.
I believe Justice Brody has one more question. We're running out of time, sir.
I want to make sure that I understand the decision tree analytically in this case. If we decide that no 3-day notice was required under Rule 55, do we ever reach the substance of the judgment? That is to say, do we ever look at whether there was an adequate evidentiary basis for the damages awarded?
I don't believe so.
Okay.
If Rule 55 doesn't apply, we rely on the wisdom of the court. We defer to their process, as Justice Stenger indicated. He would not have done it this way, but we do need to give these district court judges the ability to push these cases along, enter default, and move them along, give the notices required, follow the due process under 11.3.
Thank you.
Thank you. I don't think how much time does the appellant have?
6 minutes.
So one thing I want to address right at the outset, because it was one of the latest points, is there's nowhere in the complaint that was ever alleged that there's $1 million at stake. There's some allegations about what they call fraudulent invoices. But the fraudulent, you've got to consider the fraudulent invoices. Their contention is not that the work was not done. The contention is that it was done by Three Peaks, but invoiced by Rebel Crew. Not necessarily above board, as alleged, but the work was done. It's just by whom. And so that really puts a different spin on what the damages are, even though what the notice was. But the question I want to address is this idea that basically there are no due process protections and no guardrails if a default judgment is entered under Rule 11.3. And I think that's a very untenable proposition. Rule 11.3 specifically states that a default judgment would be entered. And defaults are clearly administered under Rule 55. They call it a default. With regard to, I believe it was Justice Brody's question, whether there's anything, any due process or guardrails with regard to the dismissal of the counterclaim, I believe this court's recent decision in Fuentes, where it clarified that a dismissal with prejudice is a drastic remedy that should not be applied unless lesser sanctions have been attempted, is on point, that there are these guardrails. There is this due process. And in this case, I don't know that we necessarily even get to Rule 55, because I think if you look at Idaho's case law, the December 23rd filing, and it was a letter with the case number that was served on plaintiffs and filed in the court, I don't know how you don't call that an appearance.
Well, counsel, 11.3 talks about appearance of counsel or notice of self-representation, mm-hmm. and that letter was neither. That letter was neither them saying we want to represent ourselves or the appearance of a new attorney. It was a third thing, which is please give us more time.
But in doing so, they are requesting relief from the court in writing and in the court to serve on a counsel. Now, it possibly does not tick all the boxes that one would like, but I would submit that the notice for default also does not tick all those boxes. Plaintiff's counsel made the argument that, you know, why are they required to certify or go back and certify the address? Well, Rule 55 says either under Rule 55A or Rule 55B, they have to certify the address. That's the rule. I mean, but despite the fact that it did not meet those requirements, it was still entered. In this case, could the letter have been more specific? We're representing ourselves for now. Please give us more time to get representation. That would have been great. It's a few extra words.
I really need to have you help me here, because I am just confused why we keep coming back to confirming the address. The letter we were just talking about, not only on the envelope, but underneath your client's signatures, it contains the same address that the notice was sent to. So why are we concerned about this? I don't understand why we keep coming back to certifying the address. Your client signed something, and right below their signatures is that address.
Well, Your Honor, with a motion for withdrawal, there's always going to be an address that has already been submitted to the court. But I'm just looking at the plain language of Rule 55 that requires that there be a certification of the address, and it's not there.
But haven't they waived the issue by signing something over that address?
How could they waive an issue before the motion for default was even filed, Your Honor?
If they were contesting that they had been properly served, they wouldn't have put the same address that the service took place at.
Well, Your Honor, that's aside from the notice of default. I mean, the notice of default has certain requirements that were not followed here. So it's one of the requirements.
To quote one of my colleagues, this sounds like a distinction that only a lawyer could appreciate.
Well, we're all lawyers here, Your Honor. I mean, again, I would really encourage the court to just look at the case law that addresses what an appearance is. And I think this is at least a doubtful case where the court should have at least considered that default should not be entered. And with regard to the computation of the damages, the court's trying to kind of play two different points here, because in one point, the court says, well, this is under Rule 55b2, but the court's analysis is just, well, apparently I could just add up what was in this affidavit and that was filed 4 months previously, and reach the damages. Well, that to me sounds like it's a Rule 55b1, that it is a an amount that can be made certain by computation. But if that's the case, it doesn't meet the requirements. The plaintiffs were required to provide an affidavit of the basis for the damages and how it would be calculated, and then the court wouldn't be faced with the point now as trying to figure out how the court reached where it was, what the basis for the damages is. And then the other point that was raised is this question that it's with the counterclaim, it is an offset. Well, that's exactly one of the points, is that the counterclaim is an offset. And the court did not offset any of the damages, did not even consider that as an issue when determining the amounts that would be provided here.
Right, because your clients for months did nothing. Their own lawyer became completely frustrated. Mm-hmm. They stopped communicating. And now after the fact, the clients want to come in and attack the judgment collaterally. They probably could have just appealed the judgment. I mean, that's the situation that we're faced with. I mean, I remember as a practitioner always wondering about how much notice do I have to keep giving these people when they don't cooperate. They don't even talk to their own lawyer.
Well, and I don't know the specifics of that issue, Your Honor, but I do know that Rule 55 does determine how much notice they're entitled to, and it determines what evidence has to be provided to support. And
when I was asking the opposing counsel about Rule 11, you've got the district court can dismiss the counterclaims, and they may enter default judgment. Is there any notice requirement for dismissal of the counterclaim?
I would submit that under the court jurisprudence in Fuentes that there is. It's essentially the same whether you call it a default judgment or whether you call it a dismissal. It still disposes of all of the claims. So I would submit that they really should be read together. But in any case, like I say, the court has held that dismissal is a drastic remedy. And, you know, as to the damages, plaintiffs later, in response to our motion to set aside, came up with a very detailed affidavit of what they claim their actual damages are. They did not rely on us to get that information. So there's no reason that they could not have presented the court with an affidavit calculating their damages, which is what's required under Rule 55b1 when they are suggesting that it can be made certain by computation, which is what really the court's alleging. You can't just do an end run and say, well, there's no affidavit, but we can just do our own computation. And it doesn't really make sense to me, Your Honor, that there's these, you have to have concrete evidence for some certain, but there's apparently no evidentiary requirement for damages under Rule B2, nothing has to be pledged, nothing has to even be identified as the basis for that.
Ms. Matthews, I think the time's up.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much, counsel. We appreciate your evidence. That is our rebuttal. We'll move on to the 6th.
All right.